This episode of All the President's Minutes is brought to you by Bella Catering and Events, who have now moved into home meals. So COVID-19 has descended on the entire world, increasingly isolated. A lot of companies are doing it really tough. I want to shout out Bella Catering as basically one of the best catering companies in Sydney, and that means in Australia. Glenn and Maria, I know, are dear friends, and they are pivoting into home-delivered meals. So the best place you can find them is bellacatering.foodstorm.com. If you are in the Sydney area, you can order a stack of food, very reasonable prices, beautiful homemade stuff, and then they can ship it straight to your house. They're currently operating on about a 26-kilometer radius around Sydney, so that pretty much covers the whole city and wider CBD and the other parts of Sydney. So reach out to them if you guys don't feel like cooking and you want some delivered home-cooked goodness in this really tough time. All right, now let's get on to the show. A reading from All the President's Men by Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward. Chapter 2. A man knew the inner workings of the White House, of which Bernstein and Woodward were almost totally ignorant, and better still, he maintained extensive records with his former colleagues. Bernstein asked if he thought there was any possibility that the President's Campaign Committee, or less likely, the White House, would sponsor such a stupid mission as the Watergate raid. Bernstein waited to be told no. I know the President well enough to know that if he needed something like this done, it certainly wouldn't be a shoddy job, said the former official.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to All the President's Minutes. I'm your host, Blake Howard. Joining me is an Iranian-American feminist, self-proclaimed, and pop culture writer, and the first film critic who has written for the Washington Post, and really first person who has written for the Washington Post on this podcast. And it's my great pleasure to welcome her on the show. In fact, I was just talking to her before we started recording about how stupid it is that we haven't spoken yet. Please welcome Roxana Haddadi. Roxana, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here. That was such a nice intro. I was like, is Blake my hype man? This is really exciting.
Look, my job as a guest, as a corralling guest on the show, is to literally be your hype man every show. That's what I do. A friend of the show, Sean Byrne, says, can you please come out to restaurants and bars with me and talk and introduce me to women? So I said, look, for a fee. I'm not in Boston enough. But yeah. If I was, I could totally do that. I think that's my destiny. You've just gotten onto my destiny. I don't know who that little guy that follows The Undertaker in wrestling is, but I think I'm that guy. So
first of all, you need that guy. Second of all, it's just a small fee. It's just a nominal amount to, you know, keep the gears rolling.
I don't see what the problem is here, guys. Let's get into it. So first and foremost, there's been a few people I've spoken to very recently on the podcast that folks are going to listen to in and around talking to you. And in a couple of episodes' time, people are going to listen to someone like Nell Minow, who is a Washington resident.
A titan.
And editor at RogerEbert.com, who often, just by virtue of living in Washington, walks around the locations that are set in this movie. And so I wonder for you, as someone who has written for the Washington Post and as someone who is a film critic, like, what's your relationship with All the President's Men?
Oh, this is such a good question. And I was thinking about it today because I was like, this is actually a really cliched story, but I love it. So I'm going to tell it. Like, I don't care. Like, whatever.
Be as cliched as you like. I love it already.
Yeah, I love it. So I think I would have to take you back to when I was a kid and I would spend summers in my dad's lab. He was a chemistry professor before he retired. He worked at Catholic University in D.C. So we were always really accustomed to going into D.C. And spending time with my dad in his lab. And I distinctly remember that every single morning he would stop at the 7-Eleven for a coffee and a Washington Post. So great. I grew up surrounded by the newspaper, like, and my dad being a very voracious reader. We lived so close to D.C. And when I was in high school, I was in like an arts magnet program, and you chose whether you wanted to do print journalism or radio journalism. And I chose print, and I think it was just because like I liked writing. I knew I liked that, and I didn't really grasp fully what it meant aside from the fact that like I could see my name being published in the school paper, which was very exciting. But so we had to take this journalism class, and I remember our journalism teacher, you know, as a cliche, was one of those people who changed my life. His name was John Mathwin. He had served in the Korean War, and he had been teaching journalism to high school students for like 30 years.
Oh my goodness. Shout out to John Mathwin for being a teacher who's just awesome.
John Mathwin was like changing lives, but he changed my life by embarrassing me. he was like, we're going to show this movie, All the President's Men. Like, this is very important. You all need to watch. And my dumb ass fell asleep within like the first 5 minutes. And he came along and he wrapped his fingers on my desk. And I remember he just looked at me and he was like, pay attention to this. And I was like, all right, let's do this. And I watched it and I loved it. And then I borrowed the book from the library. And I remember going to him and being like, I think I actually like want to do this. And he was like, all right, let's get to fucking work. So like, that's one of those cliche, like he changed my life stories, but like that motherfucker did change my life.
started with dozing in a high school, which we must say for everyone who can all reminisce. And maybe it's not as prevalent now for younger kids, but like, when your teacher used to grab a VHS and put it on in the front of a class on a TV on like a wheelie stand.
It's always on a wheelie cart. Yeah.
And it has been watched so that almost the entire VHS is worn out because they've shown it in countless classes. There was something special about that. And if it was a good movie, it did keep people awake. But you are not unusual to be a person who is dozing in a terrible movie in class in school.
Yeah, I mean, it was one of those things where I was like, all right, like, what is this really, you know, like, I am a brown woman, and in a lot of ways, I kick back against this, like, we're going to watch a movie about these old-ass white guys. Like, there's something
One of your frequent catch cries before you're prefacing a review on Twitter is like, I'm back on my bullshit again, guys.
Back on my bullshit, and these white men are driving me insane. But who knew that those white men would like bring down a presidency? Like that movie, yeah. So it really holds a special place in my heart. And you know, like I grew up on those sort of like 70s, 60s movies because my parents are both really big movie fans. So like Redford was like a known entity in our home.
Huge.
Like we watched The Way We Were, like we watched Butch Cassidy, you know, so like all of that, like that golden like 70s era of cinema is like so important and just something I love so much. So I was really pumped to be part of this.
And you know, especially one of the, you know, I mentioned Washington Post, but one of the big publications that I think, you know, seems to have some of that sort of critical DNA in it is Pejiba, who you write for, you know, indie entertainment and political website. So, you know, The Ringer has got the monopoly on sports and movies, and Pejiba has it on politics and movies, basically.
Yeah, we do like a weird, I mean, I'll be honest, like I am interested in like labor issues and talking about politics and capitalism and socialism and labor. And so I love that Pejiba like gives you an opportunity to do that.
Yes.
But yeah, like absolutely. And I think it's one of those things, you know, where people say like, keep politics out of movies. It's like, I don't think you understand that politics is like everything.
Movies are politics.
Movies
are either are kind of like radically propagandistic things that are reinforcing the values of the day. Or they're railing against them. Or in some ways, they're kind of doing that. They're doing efforts to be timeless. And there's always a dialogue. It's having a dialogue with what's being produced, or it's having a dialogue with the political influences of that filmmaker, or something like that.
It's perspective. Like, it's your perspective. It's what you want to communicate, or it's what you want to interrogate. I mean, I think we saw this like super recently with Bong Joon-ho talking about the influence of Marty Scorsese at the Oscars. It's like, Marty and his point of view for decades has been like, you look inside yourself and you find what's personal and why that matters, and then you make a movie about it. And so that can be something super intimate. It can be about gangsters. It can be about the beginning of the movie making industry. It can be Goodfellas, or it can be Hugo. Like, there's so many ways for that to go.
Yes.
And so I feel like we're living right now in this time where you're getting so many different perspectives, and that's very exciting. But I also think it's so important to know like where we came from and the movies that came before us and helped pave the way for that. And I think you had Bilge on, and he was talking about like the influence of All the President's Men, and like the influence of this movie is immense. Like, I don't think you can do any of these like procedural, sprawling, let's look into the system and how it's fucked up movies without the influence of All the President's Men. No, there's no way. I mean, I'm making that statement. There's no way.
It's so funny. I just want to pick up before we get into the influences. I want to pick up. It's so funny with Martin Scorsese, a sort of lesser story, which I equally love, is Jonah Hill was deciding to make his first movie, and he famously went to Marty Scorsese's house. This was the test of, am I going to make this as a movie? He went to Marty Scorsese's house and sat down with him, and Marty made him explain why he wanted to make the movie. And when he left, he was like, yeah, you got to do it. Like, he went to convince him why it was so essential for him to make it that he went and made it. It's just that beautiful, like, so he can either do it with his influences or not. And you're so right. It's like Scorsese is a student of the cinema, and this movie, I love placing this movie, you know, out of, it's so funny, in a time that was already, I don't know, kind of like completely loaded with the Watergate energy and that paranoia and interrogating systems of power and just distrust wholesale across the American people, and just the wild nature of every single day in that physical paper that your dad was picking up from 7-Eleven with his coffee would have been insanity, because it's just like new story after new story after new revelation after new crazy thing. And then this can come along and synthesize that energy into this really digestible, really, you know, hypnotic thing. And then later on, you just watch all these other things go, I've got to understand how the alchemy of that worked, because by all accounts, it shouldn't have. There's no way this should have worked.
Well, and that it worked so soon after. Yes. Like, Watergate wrapped in like 74. This movie came out in 76. Like, they did not sleep on it. They're like, you know what? This needs to be cinema right now.
Right now.
So that's also sort of wild to me, because I feel like, you know, in our current time, you know, it's one of those things where I do think in our current time we have so many more voices and so many more opportunities for amplitude, and there are more people joining the conversation, and in that way, like, media has fundamentally changed.
Yes.
It's so different now. But at the same time, I feel like then there's even more of these opportunities for, like, not an immediate reaction. There's more distrust, like you said. Like, there's more a sense of, like, well, what's fake news and what's factual and what's not. And I feel like there's less of an opportunity for a definitive, fact-based take that everybody accepts. Like, that's exactly what All the President's Men was. Like, the facts were clear. Like, they found the thread and they followed it.
Yes.
And you couldn't deviate from that reality. So it's just sort of insane to me to think, like, God, like, I can't imagine a movie in 2 years that's about Trump. Like, that
no.
could not happen, like, in our current reality, right? Like, we had to wait basically like a decade to get Vice about Dick Cheney. Like,
yes.
I just feel like it's taking a little bit of a longer time for us to process the bizarreness and absurdness of our current political climate, and things don't have that much certainty anymore. So it's just, it's sort of amazing to think that it was only 2 years after. Like, I can't get over that.
No, I can't either. I think that's something that everyone is going to try and interrogate on this show. It's just something, and every time I watch it, I just can't get my head around it. I can't get my head around that.
Right.
To be released in 1976 means you're producing in 1975 and maybe writing in 74. Like,
Right.
it's happening all concurrently. And so to be so precise with how things happen, and I think only really, and you and I kind of see this probably more than folk because of just the nature of what we do, is you kind of only see it in documentary cinema, like something like Citizen Four. Like, that's the last time. And Oliver Stone tried to do it with Snowden, but it was still a couple of years later. And at least they had the foundational text of Citizen Four to model how the story could be structured. But Snowden's an interesting one in that regard. But yeah, it still really feels like, to be definitive, so many movies have had to give decades of time for the definitive interrogation, And this movie just does it effortlessly and kind of just goes by. And people are like, oh, when was that movie made? Oh, like 2 years after the what? Like, how does right. this even work?
Yeah. But I think it also speaks to the fact that, like, and I don't love saying this because this sort of narrative, like, excludes so many people. But, like, it did feel, you know, a time I wasn't alive. I can't pretend that I know this firsthand. But looking back on it, it feels like everyone was involved in this story.
Yes.
And that everyone was paying attention and it had these ramifications that mattered. I don't know right now in our political climate what could happen that would matter this much. Like, it feels like things are happening without the same level of impact.
Yes.
Because we're so divided. So it's one of those things too where I look back on it, and I think you've talked about this with a lot of different guests so far on the show. It's like, god damn, is this a comforting movie. Like, this is like mac and cheese.
It's a warm hug.
Oh,
mac and cheese, you nailed it. That's what it is.
It is so many carbs. Like, it is directly into my soul.
I have to interrupt because I have to say this.
Please.
I was watching The Chef Show on Netflix. Have you watched The Chef Show?
Oh, yeah, of course.
So the other night on one of the new episodes of the show, they're eating a Wagyu beef slider.
Oh, my God.
It was a Wagyu beef brisket slider with cheese and mustard on a little brioche and eating it. Ugh. That's what this movie makes me feel like. Like, I said to my wife, I'm like, I never want to not be on carbs. I love carbs more than many human beings.
please give
me that bread. And that mac and cheese or that delicious Wagyu beef slider is what this movie makes you feel, because you're like, procedure, structure, and ultimately one thing that we haven't talked about, we're going to get into it. We're going to watch this minute in a moment, but I want to talk to you about morality. Because that's what gets me every single time in this movie, is that the ability for people to team themselves, red or blue, and stick with a binary in this and use that binary to dilute reason for so long. Like, the tipping point is so – it seems like there's no more tipping point. Like, before, there's like a – you know – if you light a stick of dynamite, the wick is only so long before people explode. Like, you can't – people will only take so much before there's a tipping point. And I think in America, that was evident with Nixon. It was like, once, you know, John Dean goes into the Watergate hearings and, like, literally writes a letter and just drops bombshell after bombshell on the whole complicity of the White House in the Watergate break-in, and the entire public goes, oh, this shit's all gone, they find that tipping point. And in this, I love just seeing these people at their tipping point of belief in these political machinations and structures. And now it seems like you could have a video of Trump shooting someone in the face and it would be like on Fox News, like, it's a fake video.
Oh, yeah, 100%. First of all, they'd be like, actually, this is a deep fake. That's what they would say first. And then they'd be like, guess what? Trump made the deep fake himself to, like, show us how bomb he is. Like, it's actually very a good thing that he did this. Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, it's one of those things where we could talk forever, honestly, about, like, how cannibalized the news media has become by, like, corporate interests. Like, we could talk about that forever. And, like, all corporate interests have their own political agenda, and all of them are pretty much interested in maintaining the status quo. But the level to which that has taken over is really disconcerting.
Yes.
So that's, I mean, you know, that's why it's like we go back to this film in terms of morality. It's like, okay, so, like, you did have a moral center that mattered.
Yes.
What happened to that? Like, where did that go?
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, I don't know. I mean, maybe we just watch the minute. Like, maybe we watch it.
Let's watch this bad boy.
Let's do it.
Look, Roxanna's taking over the show. It's her show now. Let's just do it.
Howard the Hungry. You remember when you were hungry?
Please, you get the artwork, right quarter piece. Hold on. Give us the artwork. in about half an hour. Can I have him call you? Okay. Metro desk. No, I'm sorry, he's not. Yes, I will. Can you tell me his phone? All right.
Thank you.
Yes, hold on.
Thank you.
So, I mean, I was so pumped when you gave me this minute because Howard, they're hungry. It's such a good line.
And it's the best. It's such, it's
so
Jack,
good.
Jack Warden is so great. And he's a guy, and I know I've spoken about it a few times in a few episodes, but I just want to stress how much I love how these guys at the beginning of this film, because obviously it sort of spans over about a year, or about 8 months or something to that effect. They're not as good at the beginning of this film as they ultimately are. And so much of how good they get is reliant on the faith of these people and these editors, this editorial team, giving them a shot and grooming them in the right direction, like pushing them hard and sort of, I just love that. And Howard, they're hungry. Remember when you were hungry?
Yeah. I mean, I think in another... I think in another episode of this, you talked about some of the shared DNA between a movie like this and a movie like Heat. And what I love about that comparison is like the reporter-editor relationship is so important. It's as important as any like mentor-mentee relationship. And like I get as much like joy and satisfaction out of watching these editors work with Woodward and Bernstein as I get with like De Niro and Val Kilmer.
Oh my God. It's
like,
so
I
Macaulay
it.
And Chehalis.
So,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, that relationship of like understanding, because he's got a totally different mode with everyone else in that movie except for Chris. He and Chris are like totally on a different level. But I love that. It's his same mentor relationship, and Jack Warden is doing mentor as only Jack Warden can do, completely ball busting every second that he can.
Knowing what you're capable of. Like, yes. I think that's something that's really important in this movie is that, like, everybody in this newsroom knows that they're good. Like, you're at the fucking Washington Post. Mm. Like, you have made it to a certain degree. Everyone else next to you is equally good. Like, you're going to have to prove yourself, and you're going to have to prove yourself hard. And I think what this movie does so well is it immediately lets you into that newsroom world and, like, the shifting power dynamics and how people are jockeying for stories and inches and columns and like, please don't take out that paragraph. But like, if you're going to take out that paragraph, then I want this other paragraph. And like, it really captures that shifting nature of a newsroom. And now everybody is constantly working and you're all working toward the same thing. And like, there's a real beauty, I think, in that like single-mindedness that I think we lose now with newsrooms honestly being gone as physical spaces and like a lot of telework and a lot of telecommuting. And again, like it has opened up other avenues for different voices, but man, like you can't really beat being in a newsroom. Like I'm kind of over here grinning like an idiot because like I'm remembering what that feels like, and like it feels good. Like let me tell you, it feels really good.
My aspiration is to be on the Metro desk. That's my dream. Oh, yeah. Like it's just like so if there's somehow some, you know, somehow movie publications become profitable again to the level that we could hire an office that looks like the Washington Post from All the President's Men. I'm cool to just, I didn't need to be on the national desk or the international or even stare over at Roxana at the politics desk. I just want to hover at the Metro desk, like grinding away like a hump on the phone, calling publicists. Like that's where I belong.
And that's what's beautiful, like about that era of journalism is that you could just be a Metro reporter, you know? And I don't even like using the word just in that context, but like those beats mattered. Like people relied on that news.
Metro, like especially, you know, the Metro reporters, and these guys are doing it too, like dealing with criminal activity, you know, it's an incredibly important, you create such foundational relationships that if you are good at what you do and you report well and you maintain those sources, sometimes you're breaking stories that literally, like, you become a single source. So there's, like, you know, for people to trust, like, inside police and inside, you know, crime scene investigators and all those sorts of things. Like, they will give you the leads and they will give you the exclusives that, like, kind of can define a whole city. Like, you'll get, mm-hmm. you've got the pulse on what's happening in the big story. So it's, yeah, mm-hmm. it's nothing to devalue. It's just something that unfortunately has become, you know, outmoded, but you know, you still miss it though. Like it's still,
oh,
it's,
absolutely.
It's, you yearn for it.
Well, I think it speaks to, like, there's so much isolation in our culture right now because we don't value that sort of shared experience anymore. Mm. Like, we don't value, like, the newspaper story or the beat cop or these people whose specialty is
local.
One area.
He's local.
Local. Yeah, local. And I think we have really come to expect that people are experts at everything, and that's not reality.
No.
Like, that doesn't benefit anybody. So I love watching a movie like this and thinking, like, you know, like Woodward and Bernstein, like, know exactly who to call. Like, they have their sources, they have their books, like, they know who will give them info and who won't. Like, we see them incorporate other journalists and other contacts, like, and that network of information is, I think, really driven home in the movie, like, as it progresses, is like what having a network does for you. Like, absolutely, Deep Throat is integral. Like, he is,
yes,
essential. Like, they couldn't do this without Deep Throat.
No, he's the breakthroughs, but the external, the other sources are the web, like, that actually solidify it. Because otherwise, if they don't have people to back this stuff up, Deep Throat's a madman in a car park. Like, you know, that's
right.
What he ultimately, you know, you could totally assume that, and that's why they sort of joke about him. That's why they give him the nickname, because he seems ridiculous. But when you start to get other people corroborating, you're like, oh shit, like, this is real.
Yeah.
Like, that's when
yeah.
it becomes a reality. All these other sources they're calling and things like that.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, I think that's really great. And I also think what works so well in this minute is, like, you are so fully in Woodward's perspective of,
yes.
like, I know. Okay. So, like, I can see into the glass editor's office. They have to be talking about me because, like, what else would they be talking about? More people are going in there. Oh, God. So, like, I feel like half of his attention is very clearly focused there. And then you also have Bernstein just coming around, like, looking at his copy, like, looking at what he's doing, inserting himself into this whole
he's
scenario.
So good. It's a complete...
He's so good.
It's the camera does this beautiful move. It's about 4 seconds into the minute, and it's following Woodward Redford. He's got this great posture. He's pounding away on the keyboard. On the typewriter. He gets up and he stands. The camera does this beautiful, subtle move, follows him to the copy desk. And you see, I love the differences in posture, because Bernstein's, like, sloped in his desk. His arms back, his feet are up. He's talking to someone. He's shooting the shit. He's trying to grind. And as soon as he sees him, he's like, oh, now I'm going to get to work and do that thing that I do, which is uncomfortably insert myself into a situation that I shouldn't be in. And
yes.
he does it. And you're so right. There's a wrestle between Woodward just going, I need to do my job. But up there is Ben Bradley and Howard Simons and Harry Rosenfeld. And I think the fourth person, so that's Jack Warden, Martin Balsam, obviously Jason Robards. I
mm-hmm.
think the fourth person, I'm just going to go see, might be John McMartin, who plays the foreign editor.
I think maybe because yeah, because they've just been talking about the fact of, like, they want to move the story away
move the
from
story.
Two of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like they're calling at everybody to talk over that decision.
And so they're wrestling, and it's like that beautiful Aquarian, you know, I think a great French film critic, Jean-Baptiste Thoray, came up with this phrase called aquarium syndrome. He used it for Michael Mann movies, but I love that that it looks like an aquarium. They're just in there. He looks up, and then what distracts Woodward from his pining to, like, shit, I hope they are talking about me, I hope I'm not going to get in trouble, is he glances over and just sees Bernstein lighting a cigarette on someone's desk, by the way. Like, he's lighting a match on their desk and just putting a lighting it up and just, like, looking at himself and then taking it away from the copy desk. And the copy editor's, like,
right.
looking at him. Like, she's like, oh, it's Carl, I guess. Like, this is what he does. And it's so funny because there's so much action. There's so many people around there, like, busily humping out stories, whatever they need to do. And it's mm-hmm. this capturing of attention and, like, looking around the pole and catching him at this, and with nothing being said, it's just so beautiful. Like, it's just it's a scene that has got, it's just jam-packed. It's absolutely jam-packed.
It's so good at giving you such a physical sense of this space.
Yes.
And just, like, honestly, how, like, run down and sort of shitty it is. You know, like, this is not, like...
Oh, this is shit not, everywhere.
Like, glamorous. Oh, yeah, like, there's stacks of paper everywhere. There are books. My God, phone books still existed, so there are phone books everywhere.
Yes.
I mean, it's incredibly precarious. And yet, like, my God, like, it has such vibrancy and urgency. Mm. And I always think of it because, you know, like, there are still movies... There are absolutely still movies made about journalists. Like, I don't want to say that there are not, because unfortunately there are, and most of them aren't that great. But in general, it's like a lot of them now are like, oh, they're like at these chic, beautiful, like Brooklyn lofts, and like everyone has like a 32-inch flat screen, and there are snacks everywhere. Like, it's very luxurious and opulent, and I'm like, fuck that. Where is like this phone book from 1977? Like, where?
Like, someone is there, I mean, look, people are now ironically wearing the corduroy pants, which I hate. I
yeah,
really want people
oh,
to
yeah.
like love the corduroy pants they're in and have gigantic wide ties, and I want shit over the desk too. I hate that, because you just like, if this is a real publication, you know, in like a week they're going belly up. Like, all these people
oh, yeah.
are leaving. This is not sustainable in today's market. No. Like, I think for you and I, no. maybe it's just like too much realness. You're like, nah. That's not real.
Yeah.
This can't
I'm
be
like,
right.
That's not real. Yeah, I know too much about this. Like, I absolutely know that your snack budget right now is more than a journalist is getting paid. Like,
yeah.
can we...
Like, kill the snack budget and hire a freelancer. Come on, guys. What
right.
are we doing?
Yeah, maybe get a copy editor. Like, it's not that hard. But yeah, so, like, there's so much, like, vibrancy and urgency, and there are, like, a million phones ringing, and everybody's picking up the phone, and everybody's looking at each other, but also, like, everybody is focused on what they're doing. Like, also, to
yes.
a certain degree, I could see Bernstein thinking like Woodward, like, just do your job, like, I got this, like, don't worry about it, like, it'll be okay, you know. So there's also such friction between the two of them that I love in that scene, between this like clean-cut all-American beautiful Robert Redford.
Oh my God.
And,
like, isn't it just the thing, like, people are like, you know, a few people have said, like, isn't it funny that Woodward gets played by Robert Redford? Like, I'm like, doesn't everyone want to be played by Robert Redford? I'm happy that
yeah.
he doesn't. I want to be played by Robert Redford. Like, he's going to make me look much, especially 70s Robert Redford. He's going to make me look like 5,000 times more glamorous than I really am. Like, what are we talking
what
about,
person,
guys?
What person in this world would be like, oh, actually, you want Robert Redford to play me? I'm sorry, he's too attractive and I feel compromised. Nobody's going to say that.
Never.
Are you kidding me?
That sentence has
Please.
Never been said. It's only been said
yeah.
in a hypothetical about how ridiculous someone's thought pattern would be if that was that. I love,
yeah.
it's about halfway through this minute. There's that beautiful, so much of it, I love how you said it's anchored in Woodward's perspective, and it's good to note in this minute that it is anchored in his perspective. It's him at the desk, it's him getting up, and it's not only the physical expanse of this entire newsroom, it's like the height, because, you know, for anyone who's ever worked in like a corporate side, or if you've ever worked in an office, or even like a university that you've gone to, or a library and stuff, high ceilings mean that it's quieter, because sound has an opportunity to sort of travel and then deaden. But this office is humming, because the ceilings are low and it's expansive. There's nowhere to go. Like, typewriter sounds, phone sounds, it's all there. You're right in the experience, and you're in the messy desk chaos of it all. But you get to about like 40 seconds into the minute, and finally the perspective shifts. You look over, you see this great head tilt, because Woodward catches Bernstein, and you get to look at his face looking at Bernstein, and it's that change of like POV in like 2 seconds. It's such a deft little thing, man. Gordon Willis and Alan Bakula are just freaking masters. It changes it so you're literally like, you're looking out of Woodward's eyes over at Bernstein smoking this cigarette, reading what he submitted. And when he takes it away, he kind of looks back down and is like, do I do anything with this? No, I'm going to keep typing. And then he's like, no, keep typing. Look up. What am I going to do? Sees the guys in there. And basically our minute closes. But it's just, I mean, just from a pure technical perspective there, just getting inside this guy's head, getting inside the wackiness of Bernstein. I just love it. Like, I love, there's more camera moves and execution and intentionality in that little sequence than are sometimes packed in whole movies or whole scenes. And it's just, this is a minute of a movie. It flabbergasts me.
And I think there's so much really, well, first of all, I think it's worth saying that, like, it won the Academy Awards for Best Art Direction and Best Sound, which yes. I think are so obvious in this scene. Like,
so
the
obvious.
Production design of that newsroom, fucking on point. The sound, I mean, like you said, like, that typewriter sound, like, it grabs you, like, it rattles you, like, you want to know where it's coming from, and then it's like, oh, there are, like, a million typewriters going off at the same time.
Yes.
Like, everyone is hard at work.
Everyone's
okay.
hard at work.
So that's awesome. But, like, the character work, like you said, like, the character development that is captured in just a minute, like, you get such a sense of, like, Woodward is a little bit of a Boy Scout. Like,
yes.
A little bit of this guy who is, like, doing his job, sort of worried that maybe his best isn't enough. Like, what are the editors going to think? Like, he is following the system and he is trying to do his best. And then you have Bernstein, who's just this fucking rogue agent, like, stealing copy, lighting cigarettes on desks. Like, who is this maniac? And I love
I
that you
sm-
get...
I want to light cigarettes and smoke them right at people's desks so
yeah,
badly after watching this movie.
Yeah, it's like, I, you know, and so you really also get this sense of, like, I think you really know that Woodward feels like the desk is his place and
yes.
he needs to be at the desk. And Bernstein's just floating, man. Like, Bernstein sees the entire newsroom as his place. And I think that sort of one of them being very narrowly focused and following the steps of the job, and the other one being like, well, let's look broader. Like, that is a beautiful, like, that is a beautiful balance.
Yeah.
And you get it so much also, and this is, like, skipping to another moment, but it really makes me think of the scene in the Library of Congress where we're going out and out and out and out
the,
and out. And
probably the iconic shot of the movie.
The iconic shot of the movie. But, you know, it's grounding them in that space. And honestly, how insignificant they are in that space.
Oh, yeah.
And I think this scene also does something similar where, like, for themselves, their place in that newsroom is really important in that moment. But also for tons of other people in that newsroom, they don't matter at
yeah.
all.
Yeah. In that moment, they're all doing their own stories. And we can only mm-hmm. focus on one person in one space. And so in this moment, what's so cool, and I think to reinforce your point, which is, like, Woodward's anchoring to his desk, it's even in his posture. Like, he's, like, bunched up, really great posture, and that kind of breadth comes out in Bernstein in his, like, body language. He's, like, spread out over the desk. I'll light my cigarette anywhere. I'll pick up other people's shit. I'll walk back to my desk. Like, he doesn't care. Like, he's not there. You know, there are those folks who, you know, if you've ever been in a shitty job, and, you know, some folks may be listening to this podcast, like, you're stuck in a shitty contact center job, or you're on the phones or something like that, and you kind of are anchored to your desk until your allocated break. Like, that's what it is. You feel this pressure of, if I'm not sitting here waiting for the thing or doing the thing and doing the activity, then I'm not doing my job, or I'm not going to be good at my job. And these are two, like, you know, the experience is written all over the way that they perform their role in the office there. It's so cool. And it's just, like, these are details, right? Like, just such subtle details that you're watching and getting to sort of, like, savor with every viewing. And I just also love, like, the commitment. And again, I'll reinforce it as we're in any scene here, is the background actors that are in this movie are just fucking doing it. They are just doing it. They are just so good, because they're not distracting you. You know, they're really,
right.
really great. They're like the actors that – they're more reminiscent of people who act in a – not one of those contemporary movies we talked about, like, where it's a contemporary newsroom where someone's eating snacks and they're just being annoying, like, you know, annoyingly wealthy version of something. They're more like a disaster movie extras who are all, like, freaking out in unison. But, you know, there's, like, a thing that everyone's just on it. They're just doing their thing.
Everyone is doing their task. Everyone is doing their job. And there is something deeply fulfilling about that for me, about knowing that these people are effective and confident and getting stuff done.
Yeah.
Like, there's something about that I just really love. And I feel like we don't really have movies. I mean, that's unfair. There's a movie for everything. So I don't want to say, like, this movie doesn't exist. But I think it's less common now where you get a movie about, like, the details of your job and the details of a plan. Like, we only see that now, I feel like, in the heist movies. And that's
yes.
fine. Like, I love a good heist movie. Like, please give me Fast and Furious. Like, inject it into my blood. But, like, not everybody is like a criminal, right? Like some people are just doing their jobs and they're doing it well. And so like that is really deeply fulfilling to watch in a movie like this. And honestly, like, it totally makes sense though that like this movie came from these filmmakers because like Alan Pakula and William Goldman, like that's what they did, right? Like Goldman wrote Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, like they're effective as hell. Like they totally know what they're doing. They're good at their jobs, right? And like Alan Pakula also directed To Kill a Mockingbird. Like you have The Pelican Brief in there. Like you have a lot of movies that are about procedure and about like how following the steps of a procedure can inevitably lead to something that is deeply satisfying. And like wrapping it up, like the power comes from wrapping it up and figuring out what you need to get done and getting it done. And so that's so much of the comfort too, right? Is it's like you watch this movie and like something has been accomplished and there's something really good about that.
Yeah.
Really good about that.
It's something happens, and although it's kind of, it seems like and even Bilger said this in the first episode, it's like it seems like an artistic choice, but it also seems so obvious for the time, is that they don't need to tell us that Nixon's gone because he's gone. Like the ramifications of that sort of echo through the country at the time of the film being produced and the time it was released. It was so prevalent, so they didn't need to reinforce that with this, inglorious moment where he's out. But I think they do it and then they keep doing it. Like that's the point of the movie. It's like, this is just one story. The pursuit is keep going. It's like the stories don't end. You don't retire after this. It's not done. You keep going.
And that's like the perfect line of dialogue, right? Like, isn't it Bradley who's like, don't fucking quit.
Yeah.
Like you guys fucked up. Like you made the mistake. Keep going. Like I know we're jumping around now, but like that's because like so much of the movie, like in some ways I feel like while the linear format of this movie is very much the point because we are following a specific timeline of actions, when I think about like the moments of these movie, like everything gets jumbled together because everything is so good.
Yes. Yeah. You look back and like, when was that? When did that happen?
Right. Like, when did that happen? But yeah, it's like I distinctly, and I feel like this is like, we could say so many scenes are the scene, but like asking whether you're hungry, that's a scene. Like Library of Congress, that's a scene. And Bradley telling them to like get back to fucking work. Like that's the scene.
That might be the scene. That might be the scene. Because there's the scenes and then there's the scene. Rest up 15 minutes and get your asses back in gear.
Like just get back to work. Like just do it. And honestly, like, and that is so much of what being a beat journalist is. Like it is like, all right, so like you're gonna grab like a couple minutes of sleep, eat something real quick, and then just like get back to work. And it's a grind.
Get
the fuck back to work. And we romanticize it, like, for sure. Like, I love it. But it is draining and exhausting, and it wears on you. And I think the movie also does a very good job of communicating that aspect of it, too. That, like, it is deeply fulfilling because it is work.
Yes.
And because it takes effort. And because it's not easy. And so I think there's so much of that, too. That rhythm and the pattern of that is built into the movie. Like, obviously we know how it ends. Like, we know Nixon is out, but it wasn't easy by any means. Like, things didn't fall into their laps. Like, they had to figure it out. And I think you really get the sense of that. And that's why I sort of wonder, like, when I watch All the President's Men now, is like, is that format applicable to our current reality, or do people not respect this sort of work anymore? And that's what I don't know on like a grand scale. Like that's what I wonder about. So I feel like so much of this movie feels like a time that doesn't exist anymore and a perspective that isn't as respected anymore. I don't know. I treasure it because I don't know it could get made in 2020, and I don't know if people would care to the same level that they clearly cared then.
Yeah, I think in 2020, you're so spot on. 2020, there's more of the very concept of something like fake news interrogates you know, the sort of modern clickbait era of journalism, which is, you know, inflammatory to get attention and then not looking in on the detail. It's sort of that tweet version of everything without that articulation. And I think that it's around, but I think what people are starting to do, even with podcasts and certain publications out there that still have those reputations, is they want a deep dive. They want to give things air. They want to know the details. And so many of these, you know, popular television shows and things like that, they just don't, they live and die by vox pop. And so I think it's like our modern mode might just be to interrogate, is someone trying to, you know, shine this up and make it something that it's not because they're trying to get clicks and trying to stay relevant. I don't know if that's going to change, but I feel like the tide is turning. I feel like me, maybe as an optimist, I'm feeling like the tide is turning, but I think you're so spot on about work. The work being done is draining and satisfying, and seeing that things are tough make them worthwhile.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and to my previous point of like movies do exist, because I feel like a movie that shares a lot of DNA with All the President's Men is The Report, which came out last year and starred Adam Driver.
I love The Report.
You know? Yeah, The Report is fucking great and bleak, and it crushes your soul.
Yes.
And it hurt.
Put
I mean,
her
it hurts.
On the fucking poster right now.
Yeah.
It's great, like, it's bleak, and it crushes your fucking soul.
Right. But the thing about the movie, and like I, you know, so I saw that movie at TIFF.
Mm.
It was the first movie that I saw at TIFF, my first time going to TIFF. And that movie had more walkouts than pretty much any movie I've ever seen, aside from Nicholas Winding Refn's Only God Forgives, which like
had a lot of walkouts at the Sydney Film Festival too.
Yeah,
that was great.
Yeah, and I was like, actually, this movie is dope as hell. Please leave. You don't deserve this. But yeah, like people walked out of The Report. Like I don't think people could handle like the torture scenes or the interrogation scenes, which really happened, which actually happened. And so when I think about a movie like The Report, like that movie has the same sort of pattern to me of like, you know what the truth is, and you know that you can find it if just you keep going. And like Adam Driver really captures that pursuit as well. Like I love that you said the word pursuit when we were talking about heist movies, because like that's what it is. Like you're chasing something that you know you can find. That movie was great, and that movie felt like it disappeared. Like that movie did not feel like it had cultural impact.
Didn't have a splash.
You know,
Right,
despite being excellently made, coming from Scott Burns and Soderbergh, who, I mean, I don't want to call them like indie royalty because, you know, like The Report was an Amazon Studios movie, but like you don't get much better bona fides than the two of them.
No.
Like it had Adam Driver, who is the internet's boyfriend, but like, you know, but nobody was talking about that.
And also
movie
Adam Driver has this weird Redford and Hoffman energy. He's got like that Hoffman
100%.
Hair and he's got like Redford's body. And he's just, like it's Woodstein energy. Like they're like, we need one guy. So this is the guy.
Yeah.
He can be Robert Redford or Dustin Hoffman. He does it
right.
all.
He does both. And that movie does not let off the hook the fact that like there are so many war criminals who now still have cushy, wonderful private industry jobs that were responsible for the deaths and torture of countless people. But I feel like we live in a time now where
that can get just swallowed and gone. It's disappeared.
Swallowed, gone. Like people are less interested in something that doesn't feel like it has an easy answer. And I don't think, I mean, the wars on terror aren't over. Like we're trapped in a state of endless war and these problems are still our everyday problems. So what I wonder is like what we talked about, like it felt like The Report was fairly timely. It was like, you know, a few years after the whistleblower came forward. Like it's not that far removed from the Obama presidency, and the Obama presidency was trying to clean up things that the Bush presidency did. So again, it's like it didn't feel like it was that much time, but like it just didn't make an impact. Whereas All the President's Men, like it is still up on that pedestal. So that's like the kind of stuff that I think about when it's like, I don't know what would have cultural impact in the same way as this movie did. Or like you said, or even Snowden. Like Snowden is still very much like a hero among various circles of the internet. I mean,
yeah.
I feel comfortable saying that, like, I respect Snowden for what he did. Like,
I respect him deeply. Know? And it's funny that that movie is timely as well, but both of those movies, it's like the – I think they're both and I think the report, this is the mastery. Like, so Snowden, you know, because obviously Oliver Stone is a more sort of cantankerous filmmaker mm-hmm. and personality. Like, he's going out there to back the whistleblower in all ways, shapes, and forms. So, you know, and so
right.
– and that is – I think Citizen Four has at least that, like, a little bit more measured, that it's the reality, and, mm-hmm. and he's underscoring it a little bit more. But the report is made with a very partisan lens. Like, it's not there's mm-hmm. it's not solely saying this is the problem of Republicans. It's talking about manipulation of individuals, like in mm-hmm. people's vulnerability to do bad shit. And then when they're called on it and they're caught on it, it's about the cycles of all those defenses putting up until eventually people, like, literally have no choice to scream and to go to the media and utilize that channel. So it's really interesting. But I think, you know, this is one thing I think for the report, and this is what I think we're going to find, and you and I are going to probably be some of those people because of our lives on the internet that are going to find them, is there are great films now that sometimes take a few years to breathe. And I feel like yeah. The Report is a movie that in 2 or 3 years people are going to go, you know, there's a common phrase that I know, that I think you and I have interacted with one another about them. It's just like, this movie didn't get any justice from us, guys. We failed. Like, we failed.
We failed. We failed.
And there'll be movies in the next few years where we're like, guys, we failed at this one. And we really need mm-hmm. to reinterrogate it. And the great thing about some of these streaming things, especially with Amazon at the moment, is, like, they don't have a big pool of original films. So they, you know, if you own Prime, you can go and revisit it. And I think I've luckily gone back and watched The Report a few times now because it's got that same energy that I'm pursuing here. So it's just, we're going to find it. I think they'll emerge. Like, in the swamp of all this new shit that's out every day, you know, things still cut through. And sometimes they just take a little bit of time. And all it takes is a couple of us to, you know, stands of certain things with, you know, and it's got the internet's boyfriend. People are going to go back. I love that you call it the internet's boyfriend. People are going to find it and go, this is fucking great. This is excellent. And it throws some serious shade at Zero Dark Thirty, which I'm a fan of.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Zero Dark Thirty is one of those movies. So, like, you know, like, as an Iranian American, like, my birthday is September 12th. Like, I experienced some shit after 9/11. My parents did. I saw how it changed my family. And so, like, Zero Dark Thirty was one of those movies. And, like, this is probably, like, the most embarrassing thing I've ever written. Like, I can look back on this now and be like, I shouldn't have written that shit. Zero Dark Thirty came out, and I wrote an essay for Exo Jane about how I'm laughing about it because it's so deeply uncomfortable. I wrote this essay that was like, I think Zero Dark Thirty and, like, us capturing Osama bin Laden will hopefully make things better because, like, everyone blames bin Laden for 9/11, and, like, hopefully this will be, like, the end of this cycle of, like, racism and discrimination and et cetera. And it was a very naive, like, very rose-tinted glasses.
Very optimistic. He's
very optimistic.
And it happens when you're young, you're optimistic.
Yeah, you're young. I was like, oh, of course things will change. Please, things don't change. But but I look back on it now and it's like, you know, like, it feels bad to remember that you once had hope.
Mm.
And that's terrible. Like, that's full. But, like, that's the thing about Zero Dark Thirty is it's like, I feel like it came at this perfect time where it, again, when we're talking about timeliness, like, it was fairly soon after bin Laden was captured and killed. Like, it was very much the movie that America needed to tell itself that it was doing a good job on the war on terror and that this was winnable. And I remember my boyfriend and I saw it together, and he studied Middle Eastern history, and he kept leaning over to me and being like, why is this CIA expert played by Jessica Chastain mispronouncing easy things in Arabic? You know? So that's the sort of thing where it's like, I think about that movie and how it was the movie that America needed at that time and absolutely the one that it shouldn't have gotten, because I think it helped kick us off onto this series of movies like 13 Hours and Six Underground and these movies that confuse nationalism and patriotism and heroism and all of these concepts that I feel like we can't fuck around with confusing at this current moment.
Yes.
But those are the movies that are going to get made. But I think about those movies and All the President's Men, and I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go with All the President's Men being the more heroic film.
Yes.
You know, because like what they were doing was deeply dangerous. And I think the movie makes that clear. Like, it was CIA. It was intelligence people. It was the government. Like, in that moment in time, it did feel like everyone was out to get them and to contain this story. And I think that sense of fear is very palpable in All the President's Men in a lot of ways that I don't find in modern films, where a lot of times we are relying on these faceless, poor, Muslim, brown terrorists. Like, when I watch All the President's Men, like, you remember the phone call is coming from inside the house.
Yeah.
You know?
The real enemy are the white guys and the CIA.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The
not the poor brown people.
Yeah, I don't know if you have like a direct line to John Krasinski, but remember when he was like, we should actually be thanking the CIA every day? I'm like, no dog, that's not.
Look, one thing we can hope is that this show is a direct line to John Krasinski. We like A Quiet Place. More power to you, my friend.
Actually, yeah, if you just don't talk about the CIA, but you do send us a screener of Quiet Place,
Place 2. Would love that. Big fans. Also, congrats on being married to Emily Blunt. She's the best. Yeah.
Right. So, don't know how that happened.
Don't know how that happened.
Good for you.
Well done.
Good for you.
Congrats.
However, also, good idea with casting Cillian Murphy. I will say that looks like a masterstroke in Quiet Place 2.
Well, I think the perfect way to end today's episode of All the President's Minutes is with a quote directly from my amazing guest, Roxana, which is, things change, please. You can find her at Roxana_Haddadi, HADADI on Twitter, and you can follow her there to all of her other places, Pajiba, Brightwall Dark Room, she's written for, the best independent movie website that there's going around in this guy's opinion. Roxana, you've been amazing. Thank you so much for being a part of the show. You have to come back. We're going to find another minute to talk about somewhere along the
line. Yeah. That would be amazing. I mean, this was really, I really had a good time. Thank you for, you know, as I always say, thank you for letting me get back on my bullshit. So I really appreciate it.
You are welcome.
Huge thank you to my special guest, Roxana Haddadi. You can find her on Twitter at Roxana_Haddadi, Roxana_Haddadi, HADADI. And that leads off to RoxanaHaddadi.com and all of her other stuff. She's been an amazing guest, and I can't wait to have her back on the show. Thank you so much again for listening to All the President's Minutes and anything on the One Heat Minute Productions feed. I'm your host, Blake Howard, and producer of Increment Vice, as well as everything that's been happening on the One Heat Minute Productions feed. If you want to follow me, simply go to at OneBlakeMinute on Instagram and on Twitter, or to OneHeatMinute.com to find out everything that's happening with the show and about the show. If you guys want to support us, we have a link on OneHeatMinute.com to our Patreon. If you can spare even a couple of bucks a month, the cost of a coffee a month, you are going to be contributing to this show, the amazing Increment Vice, and any other amazing shows that are a part of One Heat Minute Productions. Thank you so much in advance. If you can't support us, you don't have the cash, that's totally fine, but please subscribe, rate, review, and share the shows. We would love, if you are digging the show, share them with like-minded film folk around the place. Thank you so much once again for listening to this episode. We'll catch you on another episode of All the President's Minutes and another episode in the One Heat Minute Productions feed very soon.